Good afternoon. Thank you for coming to this event. I'm the secretary of the Penn Board, so in that capacity, I welcome you. And my name is Roxana Robinson, and I also am I'm your stand-up critic for this event. Throughout this week, the National Book Critics Circle team of six critics has presented at every event a list of recommended books. And I'm here to tell you about a contemporary novel, a translation, a classic, a small press indie, and a surprise. So the first one, the contemporary novel, is A Visit from the Goon Squad by Jennifer Egan. It's one of the best contemporary novels I know, and since I made this list up, it has been awarded the Pulitzer Prize. So I feel supported in my choice. It has a brilliant, shimmering surface. It has an astonishing velocity and a very imaginative construction. But what's breathtaking is the confidence with which Egan moves through time, generations, and the music business. When we're finished with this book, it feels as though we've read Proust compressed. The classic is Madame Bovary by Gustave Flaubert, translated by Lydia Davis. A great book by a great, written by a great writer and translated by a great writer. How good can it get? Flaubert's mesmerizing narrative about the flawed and gorgeous Emma continues to confound us. We fall under her spell from our first glimpse of her, with the shadows cast on her face by silk and rain. Throughout the book, Flaubert wrestles with his own ambivalence about her. And who are we to disagree with this ambivalence? The third one, the classic, is Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy, translated by Pavir and Volkonsky. This is one of the great cornerstones of European literature. The narrative is formed by two great arcs, that of Levin, slowly rising, and that of Anna, making her doomed descent. Tolstoy's attentiveness to character and ideas, his deep meditative love of his world, inform this novel and sweep you into it. Once you've read it, it will never leave you. The fourth, the small press indie book, is called Widow. It's by Michel Latulippe. This is an elegant book of stories, precise and glittering like jewels. Latulippe writes exquisite Mandarin prose in sentences you want to memorize. The stories are about excruciating loss and about other things as well, being alive, having sex, being betrayed, and having fun. And the stories will stay with you. The last book, The Surprise, is Uncle Tom's Cabin by Harriet Beecher Stowe. I made this choice in recognition of the 150th anniversary of the start of the Civil War, and because the author is my great-great-great-aunt. Great-aunt Hattie was a woman of moral conviction, and though this book is not a work of great literature, it's a work of great courage, and it was written at a time when her thoughts and ideas were considered unacceptable. I'm proud to be a member of her family. So those are the books. I want you to go out and buy them all this afternoon and read them by tomorrow morning. And now I will introduce to you the distinguished panel who's going to be part of Leopardi's Conti, A Conversation. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Rosanna Warren, and on behalf of the 3,400 writers, translators, and editors of Penn, it's our great pleasure to welcome you to the 7th Annual Penn World Voices Festival of International Literature. I want to thank the festival sponsors and supporters who made all this possible, as well as the Standard, New York, and Highline, which are serving as the festival's hubs this year. And I want to thank the 130 volunteers who have been angelic in shepherding everybody around. That's astonishing. The festival continues its cheerful frenzy later this afternoon. You can find out the complete schedule of events go at www.penn.org. And during this session, a clipboard will be going around, I'm told, so you can add your name to that to get the Penn newsletter. And Susan Bernofsky at 3 o'clock is running a translation, another translation panel at Cooper Union. So I hope you'll all rush over there and continue to be invigorated by the ideas of translation. This year, the festival commemorates the 25th anniversary of the 1986 Penn Congress, when President Norman Mailer asserted that not only did writers use their imaginations to speak to one another across boundaries, but that governments, too, were capable of using writers' visions to improve the world's troubles. Can writers today still speak and be heard? That's a question I think that's at the core of Penn and the core of this festival. This festival addresses the role and responsibility of the writer in public discourse and asks how literature and politics can go hand in hand. Books are available for sale at the table outside, where the authors apparently will be willing to sign them. And of course, I have to ask you, please, to turn off all your zingers and bingers and bongers and wheezers and chokers and buzzers and music boxes that you have in your pockets. So thank you very much for coming. And now I will introduce our guests and start our conversation. As president of Farrar Straus, Jonathan Galassi is mysteriously able to foster the work of many other writers while keeping the flame lit for his own writing and translating. He's published two books of lovely poems, Morning Run and North Street, and has translated much of the oeuvre of the great Italian poet Eugenio Montale. Just now, he has brought out this monumental translation of the complete Canti of Giacomo Leopardi, the work which prompts this conversation today. I'll put it here so we can see it as a fetishistic object. Leopardi, who died in 1837 at the age of 39 after a life of crippling illness, helped to create modernity. That is, he helped to create us. And he is fiendishly hard to translate. His Italian has classical dignity and an effortless saturation in Greek and Latin. It is also, in the lyric idylls, starkingly direct and almost naked. With a cunning combination of metrics in English and delicate phrasing, Jonathan Galassi has performed a near miracle. Here is how Galassi hears the last lines of La sera del dì di festa, the evening of the holiday. Afterward, I'd be awake, unhappy, and late at night, a song heard on the road, dying note by note as it passed by, would pierce my heart the same way even then. We might think of the song heard passing on the road as something to do with the work of translation and how it can pierce our hearts. Joachim Sartorius has the perfect biography for a translator, it seems to me. Born in Germany, brought up in Tunis, he did advanced study in Munich, London, and Paris, and then he worked for years as a diplomat in the United States, Turkey, the Czech Republic, and Cyprus, before then heading the Goethe Institute all over the world, all those institutes. And since 2001, he has been the director general of the Berlin Festivals. He's translated many American poets, including John Ashbery, and he's translated Malcolm Lowry, William Carlos Williams, and he's put together an important international poetry anthology from English. He's also had time to write six books of his own poems, including the most recent, Hôtel des Étrangers, which has appeared in English as well as in a number of other languages. His selected poems appear in English in this handsome volume from Carcanet, from which I take these lines, which I love. There is no repairing the nation we remember, I said. That's from a poem called Little Queen of the Beautiful Whores. So now I invite Jonathan to start us off with some remarks, then Mr. Sartorius, then they will argue with each other or perhaps praise each other, who knows, and then we will invite you to join the conversation.
Thank you, Rosanna, and thank you, Mr. Sartorius, for being here. It's an honor to share the stage with two such distinguished writers and critics and devotees of literature. I worked on this book for about 10 years. I started it because I had worked on translating Montale, as Rosanna said, and when that project was done, I wanted to continue my engagement with Italian poetry. And I looked around and I didn't see a contemporary Italian who interested me as much as Montale, so I decided to look backwards. And it wasn't too far backwards to look to light on Leopardi. There have been numerous translations of Leopardi, but in my prejudiced view, there haven't been very many good ones. And poets thrive on multiple translations, in my opinion. I think that there is no such thing as the translation of anybody. And that gives people like me license to fantasize about engaging ourselves with a writer, especially a writer in the public domain, where you don't need anyone's permission to do it. You can just pick up your pencil and start working. So I foolishly did that. I say foolishly because though I knew Leopardi was hard, I had no idea how hard. One thing about doing translation, I'm sure Mr. Sartorius or Rosanna will agree with that, is that once you start, once you really dig into the work, you discover how very hard it is to put yourself into the, try to put yourself into the mindset of another writer, particularly one from another era. And in the case of Leopardi, it's not just that he was a 19th century poet. He was actually a 19th century poet who had one or several of his feet in the past, he's a Petrarchan poet. He's an aulic poet, as the Italians love to say. He's also the first real modern Italian poet, but he definitely bestrides Italian poetry with his back foot reaching really almost all the way back, and he was also a very great scholar as a child. Really, as a child, before he was 10 years old, he started doing translations. His father, who was a sort of ne'er-do-well minor aristocrat in Recanati, a backward little city in the Marche, which was a backward part of Italy. It was part of the Papal States, and a very reactionary, but quite a kind and delightful man, probably, had... His main accomplishment in life was acquiring a very, very deep library, especially in patristic literature and classics. Leopardi wasn't so interested in patristic literature, although he did some of his early projects actually were religiously based, but he soon lost his religion. And part of the way he lost it was by reading all those classical authors who were, after all, the classics were the basis of education in Europe. But I don't think they were read as deeply as Leopardi read them usually. And as a friend of mine who's a great Leopardi scholar, Franco Dintino is his name, said his teachers, the priests who taught him and his father, and so they wanted him really to learn Latin literature, which was the basis of Italian culture, really, and more public, but it was really the Greeks that really spoke to Leopardi. They were, Franco calls them the prohibited Greeks. They were pagan. They were Epicurean, stoical. They were erotic, really, it was Greek poetry, I think, that really turned Leopardi on, I think that his idols, which were his most personal poems, well, I should back up and say he wrote two kinds of poetry all his life, and let's say he died at 39, and he started really writing at 19, so it's 20 years only of writing, which is very tragic that such a great writer should have such a short lifespan. But of course, many of the greatest artists of the centuries before the 20th had short lives, starting with Mozart and Keats and an endless list of people. But in any case, he wrote two kinds of poems all the time. He wrote public, civic odes that were inspired by Horatian poetry and by Dante, by a whole tradition of Italian public poetry. And then he wrote his idols, his personal effusions that were private, that were anguished, and I think were inspired by reading Greek poets. That alternation between the public and the private, between the pastoral and the civic, is what Leopardi's work is really all about. But I had no idea of that when I started this project. I just thought I thought he was a great poet. I knew L'Infinito. And I knew La Ginestra, which is his big summary poem, which sort of combines those two modes. But I didn't know the deep well that I was diving into, and there were many moments of despair along the way, I'll say, because so much of Leopardi's language is unmodern. There's really no way to make verse or contemporary sounding lines out of some of his more public utterance. I tried, but I'm more satisfied with other parts of the work. But anyway, I think that's enough from me for now. I would, but my point really is that the translator, when he engages deeply with his victim, taken over by a world that just deepens and deepens and becomes more and more absorbing and terrifying. And I think that my friends here would probably agree with me on that.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your kind introduction. And I think it's great for me to be here with Rosanna Warren, a poet I admire very much, and Jonathan Galassi, a mighty publisher. And a fellow poet and a fellow translator. So also the Canti of Leopardi are, of course, the main focus of this hour of discussion. I would like to start with a few remarks on translation or translating poetry in general. And I think you all know this very famous adage, poetry is what gets lost in translation. I don't know who has coined it. Was it Robert Frost? Or
yeah. He probably lifted it from someone else.
But there's also a big consolation, because I think hundreds and hundreds of translators have proved over the centuries that this is not the whole truth. And I think the problem with translation poetry is that there's so much language specific in a poem, and it's very hard to replicate this. On the other hand, I think every language we know has a huge universal dimension, a zone of meanings shared with other languages. And in my view, this universalist dimension is a wire on which, well, we are performing this high wire act of translation. And it is, of course, easy to fall on either side of the wire, the over-literal or the lax. But we should not forget that the best translations are glorious indeed. I believe myself that much of the active inner structure of image and sentence and idea and underneath the universal idiom of thought and feeling can be replicated. And out of all this too, something like an X-ray of the original or pervading vision. I think there are as many theories of translation as there are translators. But for me, I think I must walk, when I translate, for example, Wallace Stevens, the wire between poetic integrity and faithfulness, between doing it right within the music of German and doing it right by the literal thrust of the original. Now, it is amazing that most of the time, poets are translated by poets. And it's interesting talking about Montale. He was translated by a very famous German poet, Ingeborg Bachmann. Or if you take Ossip Mandelstam, translated by Paul Celan. But it's interesting, if you read this Mandelstam or Montale in German, you have the feeling, oh, this is a great, great German poem. Mm-hmm. The German language has waited for being for getting this translation. But if you look closer at it, so Mandelstam is perhaps 50% Paul Celan and 50% Mandelstam. Mm-hmm. And so it's always a question, you know, I want to quote, I'd like to quote Ted Hughes, who once said, when he translated the great Polish poet Janusz Pilinski, there's no question of introducing anything from the translator's own poetical medicine bag. So this was Ted Hughes. Another point I want to make is that there's, I think, a big difference between translating dead poets like Leopardi or translating poets well alive, because well, you can always ask living poets and put hundreds of questions to them. I did this very often with John Ashbery, and I must say he was utterly unhelpful. always charming when I asked him, but what did you mean with this line and this image? Oh, Achim, I can't remember. I don't know what I thought at that moment. But what is interesting, one evening a long time ago, I read to him about 20 or 30 of my German translations, and also he doesn't know German, but he is a great fan of music, of German music, of German Lieder, and he has a fantastic ear. So just to listen to my poor German versions, he said, oh, this musical thing I didn't like so much. And so we worked most of the time on this level, and this was really quite interesting. But with Leopardi, I think it's a very hard case, because I think you have a huge amount of other translations. You have you mentioned his most famous poem, L'Infinito, Infinity. I think there are more than 48 German translations. And the last one I knew was from a well-known experimental Swiss poet, Felix Philipp Ingold, and he translated it from the last line to the first. but it worked. I send it to you.
Yes, I'd love to see that.
Well, I would like to finish these general remarks by quoting one French poet, a French living poet, Michel Deguy. He has linked the quality of a poem, in fact, to its untranslatability. And he said, the poem is the more itself, the more it cannot be translated. And he added, the more the poem is linked to locality, to local specifics of a language, the more it is removed from exchange. So I think this is a very interesting quotation, and we could discuss about it also with you. Now, a few remarks about Leopardi. Of course, in Germany, he is considered to be the most important Italian poet of the 19th century, as everywhere else. But he is famous in Germany not so much for his, as you say, public poems or civic poems. Everyone knows his idylls, and I mentioned already so many German translations of Infinity. In Germany, he is considered to be an immediate follower of Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the French thinker. And if you go back to the French thinker Pascal, who was the first one who really felt as a human being surrounded by nothingness, by vast spaces in which you get lost. But Pascal had religion, and Mr. Leopardi had not such an anchor, and I think this makes a big difference. So for him, for Leopardi, happiness of man was rooted only in illusions or in his imagination. And in his Zibaldone, I think this is his big diary, or how would you say?
Notebook,
which I think will be published by Father Georges Giroux in the next years. It's a great endeavor. I just quote one line. He jotted down in his Zibaldone, "I gave myself over to the wild joy of desperation." But in Germany, when you read the reviews, I think what is always put forward is that he was the first one who has given a language to the unhappy consciousness. And this makes him, in a way, so modern. And the other important thing for German readers is, you know, he was almost a contemporary of our famous Friedrich Hölderlin. Mm-hmm. Now, both share the same love for the old writers, for the ancient writers, for Homer. And both, I think, Leopardi and Hölderlin also felt that they cannot top these ancient writers or old ancient
yes.
Writers. And I think there are many passages in Leopardi's Zibaldone. I think he thinks that the ancient writers had one big advantage, that they had less knowledge about the situation of man in the universe. So knowing less strengthened somehow their writing. And their imagination was simple, it was plain, but thus overwhelming. So perhaps I should stop
Wonderful.
Here. Sorry, perhaps I haven't
Perfect.
Been too long.
No, not at all. This is generous.
Could I say a couple
Please.
Of things?
That's what the idea is. That's why you're here.
No, it's true that Leopardi's idea was that the imagination throve on mystery, on the unknown, and that science, growing knowledge, diminished happiness and imaginative illusion, as Mr. Sartorius said. I want to raise this whole issue of the untranslatability of poetry, though, because if you really think about it, what is literary culture but translated, a translated common culture. The Bible, Dante, the classic, the Greek classics, the Roman classics, etc. Just to start with those things. Those are the common inheritance of you and me, French and Michel Duguay. And what's if we decided that you know, that the Gilgamesh epic was not translatable, where would we be? We're starting from somewhere, which is from standing on the backs of the great writers of the past, and they're all translated many times.
But I think French want always to be a little bit provocative. So I think this is perhaps one reason he said this, but also I think it was, he said it at a discussion at the French Bibliothèque Nationale, so comparable place to this one, and the main subject was that poetry is so marginalized, so much not a commodity, you know. In Germany, you are lucky as a poet if you sell 600 or 800 copies of your book. So I think it was also that he wanted to console the poet, saying, you know, it's not a commodity on the market. It doesn't be an object of exchange. But in my way, he's wrong. I think there would be no literature without all this translating business.
He seems to be talking about a certain kind of modern poetry that defines itself, excludes itself from this tradition in a way. And there, of course, there have always been local writers, local art, but in a way, he's saying he'd prefer not to be part of the common language, and I think that. That is a kind of art. It's like a Dada, or it's a kind of art of refusal that is a modern thing. Nevertheless, we publish translations of European poets, like Doris Grunbein. We were talking about him earlier, and I can't say that we've sold more than 800 copies of his translation either. But his book. His work has been translated, and Rosanna is involved in a translation of her own work right now, and I think that the activity of cultural exchange that continues to go on, that this festival is a part of, it testifies to the fact that there may be specific features of poems that aren't translatable, but the poems themselves are. Something happens, that's something's gained, communicated. Otherwise, we wouldn't be wasting our time doing it.
Well, I think it was very important that you mentioned your musical exchanges with John Ashbery, because there you had the realm of semantics had dropped out, and it was the realm of the ear, the realm of rhythmical patterning and vowel and consonant patterning, and yet it was a significant way in which you two could understand and even be critical about the structure that was being created.
But that's a question I wanted to ask Mr. Galassi, because I'm quoting your foreword here. You say there's such different undertakings in the Kanti, very different poems and style and syntax and everything. So there are shifts in tone and material. I imagine the greatest difficulty is to render all these alternating voices, and especially the musicality. And some of the poems you quoted, the broom, it's also very monumental for language. Was this a main
problem? Leopardi's poetry is a very special case, I think, because he wasn't writing poems the way we do. He was using poems to explicate his ideas. He was making essays, attempts to express his ideas in verse form, and he kept doing different things with them. He was very experimental all his life. He only had one book, 41 poems. He kept adding to it. He kept shuffling the order. And he tried many different kinds of writing in this book. So it's not a collection of lyrics. It's a compendium of odes, satires, lyric poems, and philosophical poems. It's really, I can't think of an English book that's anything like it. So to try to deal with that stylistically in English is, you know, very daunting and, you know, very hard to, impossible to pull off. But I think that there are these stylistic differences in Italian, but there's also the unity of his voice. Yeah. And so at least there's that, you know. Yeah. At least it's not an anthology of 41 different poets.
Right.
Although there seem to be 41 different Leopardis sometimes, you know. But I think that what you can't do in English with Leopardi is achieve the amazing musicality and beauty of this very abstract language of his work. Mm. Because our language is much more concrete. The beauty of Leopardi's language is in the sound of it itself, the vowel-based Italian. Our language is much harsher. So he can say very bold things in very perfect ways, and that's enough to make an incomparable poem. We have to do something different. Yeah.
Jonathan, I wonder if I could ask you to read out loud your translation of L'Infinito. I think that would help us all to have the voice in the room here.
It's too bad we can't have an Italian reading of it, but
yeah.
Is there anyone in the audience who's willing to Anthony, come up and read L'Infinito,
please.
Mr. Viscusi is going to read it.
Oh.
I think that's a good idea. Anthony Viscusi. He knew this poem in school. No, not like you.
What is the page?
106.
I give you my copy so you can read it.
Okay. All right. Thank you.
Sempre caro mi fu quest'ermo colle e questa siepe che da tanta parte dell'ultimo orizzonte il guardo esclude. Ma sedendo e mirando interminati spazi di qua da quella e sovrumani silenzi e profondissima quiete io nel pensar mi fingo, ove per poco il cor non si spaura. E come il vento odo stormir tra queste piante, in quello infinito silenzio questa voce vo comparando, e mi sovvien l'eterno, e la morte stagioni, e la presente e viva, e il suon di lei. Così da questa luminosità s'annega il pensier mio. E il naufragar m'è dolce in questo mare.
I'm sure he could have recited it by heart. He once told me how he when he was younger, he hated Leopardi because he had to study him in school. And I think there were plenty of people like that. Infinity. This lonely hill was always dear to me, and this hedgerow, which cuts off the view of so much of the last horizon. But sitting here and gazing, I can see beyond in my mind's eye, unending spaces, and superhuman silences and depthless calm, till what I feel is almost fear. And when I hear the wind stir in these branches, I begin comparing that endless stillness with this noise. And the eternal comes to mind, and the dead seasons, and the present living one, and how it sounds. So my mind sinks in this immensity, and foundering is sweet in such a sea.
Thank you.
Leopardi was, I think, 20 years old when he wrote L'Infinito. And I was actually about 23 when I did this translation.
Huh.
And it was my first poem I tried to translate into. And I've changed a couple of words for the book, but it was 1973.
That's
Bravo. A long time ago. So,
Jonathan, could you talk a little bit about enjambment in this poem, which is about enclosure and about being hidden and having the view obstructed? It's almost a demonstration case about the ending of lines and yet how lines open up into other lines and inner vision and outer vision.
Yes, it's very true. And Anthony's reading actually accented that.
Yeah.
How the lines, you know, it's written in very regular meter, but the sentence is very sinuous and flows, keeps flowing, keeps on coming, and that you can't imitate sound patterns in from one language to another, but you can try to have a kind of rhythmic, what I call rhythmic equivalence, mm-hmm. and you can replicate the movement of the sentences. Sometimes you make it slightly different because your language is your own. But I think that what you talk about Ashbery listening to you, to him in your German, I think that my goal is similar in trying to translate Leopardi is that there's a rhythmic subtext that is translatable,
mm-hmm.
and that provides the baseline for the translation, for a successful translation, I think. Rosanna, tell us about your own translations. What have you...
Oh, well, that's not what we're here for.
Well, we're all in this together.
They vary from having spent years translating a play by Euripides from Greek, and that was for stage, so trying to get a verse drama in English on stage that gave some kind of rhythmic equivalence to the contrast within the Euripides play between the iambic meters of Stichomythia, of discourse and debate, and the complicated choral odes, which were almost, I came to think, operatic arias. So that was very much a project that had to do, for me, with a rhythmical imagination about, and also drama, putting it on stage, and so that actors could speak this in a way that was believable. That was just one long challenge that I experienced. But coming back to Leopardi, for instance, one of the things that strikes me about Leopardi as a poet is, along with his the classicizing dignity and his agelessness of his rhetoric, there is also a very simple kind of vernacular Italian. And in the L'Infinito, which we've just heard, in the Italian, the lines "E morte stagione le e la presente è viva e il suon di lei," which you translate, I think, wonderfully. You get the tone of that when you say, "The eternal comes to mind, and the dead seasons, and the present living one, and how it sounds." That American colloquial "and how it sounds" is very important for the poem, because otherwise it would go off like a helium balloon. And I just wanted to compliment you on that, because I think that if you don't get the dignified colloquial in Leopardi, you've missed him. You'll only get the school Leopardi. Well, and perhaps you don't agree.
No, I think, I mean, Leopardi's great, what we call his greatest poems, take place in this little village, basically. And the characters of the poems are the people in the town, you know, the carpenter and the vegetable seller and the girl in the window, you know, the maids in the house, etc. And it is very vernacular. It's mythicized. It becomes eternalized by this kind of symbolic treatment of these characters and all. But it is very homegrown at the same time, and it's that. And of course, that's true of classical literature too. And he borrows that from classical writing, but it's utter simplicity. I mean, the utterness of it is what's the art. But it's
the difficulty. I don't know what's more difficult than simplicity.
Yeah, you can't hide. You know, that's absolutely true.
Maybe we could ask you, Mr. Sartorius, what are some of the greatest difficulties you've encountered in translating 20th century American poetry? What was hardest for you to get?
I think by far Wallace Stevens.
Wallace Stevens. And what about Stevens? I mean, I know he's difficult, but what exactly, technically or in?
Well, I think you have so many, perhaps it's true of all poems, but in Stevens you have so many different levels. You have a level of just thought or thinking or philosophical level. Then you have a musical level. You have a level of form, how the text is organized on the white sheet, syntax, and so on. And I think you have also a level of cultural context with Wallace Stevens. Mm-hmm. So you have these four levels, and I think if you are lucky as a translator, you might render two, or if you're very lucky, three of these levels, but not all of them. And I think it's interesting, we talked about the difficulty of translating the musicality of Leopardi, but it's also very true of Stevens, because mm-hmm. he is extremely melodious.
Yes.
And he likes repetitions and
he's very monotonous too.
And small changes in these repetitions, and it's almost impossible to render this in German. This was my greatest problem.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Perhaps we could invite questions now from you. And would you please stand up and introduce yourself when you ask a question? And we need you to speak into a microphone because this is being recorded. And may I ask, of course, don't give a long speech, please, to leave room time for other people to say something. Yes, sir.
We have some ringer translators here in the audience.
My name is Michael Moore. I also translate from Italian. And I was thinking, as you were talking about translation in the history of literature, in a broader literary historical context, of the example of Petrarch, who I think that anyone who would try to translate Petrarch today would really give up and say it's impossible. It's a very narrow vocabulary. But it was precisely the translation of Petrarch's sonnets in 16th century England that changed our own literary history and created courtly poetry in English, not only in England but also in France, in Spain, and I believe in Germany. And it sort of makes me wonder whether something isn't lost in translation, but maybe something is lost in our ability to translate. I'm not quite sure what it is that makes someone like Petrarch so difficult to translate today and instead so fluid once upon a time. And I was wondering whether these one possibility certainly might be the fact that when these translations were being done and when Leopardi himself was writing, there was such a question about whether or not there's such a big debate. I am giving you a long question, but the whole question of qualitative versus quantitative verse, Greek verse being quantitative, this notion of the heaviness of the syllable as opposed to simply accented verse. One of the comments that's often made about Ashbery is that he has a perfect ear, that in a certain sense his poetry brings together both the qualitative and the quantitative. But I guess it's sort of an open question of what is it that makes the poetry of the past so difficult, and also an invitation to sort of look at translation, however imperfect, as a real driving force in literary history.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would just say that I think that probably the most important aspect of translating Petrarch in the 16th century was that there was a kind of unitary literary culture that we there was a shared political situation, a shared religious background to it, you know. I think that, and the distance wasn't very far, is what I'm saying. Whereas today, you're hundreds and hundreds of years away, and culture is totally different. But it's true. Wyatt and Shakespeare and others translated, made great poems out of. They weren't always literally accurate, but they were inspired by Petrarchan sonnets. It's absolutely true, and it was the, in some ways, the making of English lyric poetry.
Yes.
I think it's, isn't it largely a question of the receptivity of a language, and I think it is such a tour de force what you did with Leopardians, but the receptivity of a language. You mentioned Celan's translation of Mandelstam, right? And you said it was 50% Celan rather than Mandelstam. Now, this is astonishing because they had so much in common. Celan is Amschel, no? And it's a transcription of Amschel. So they were both from this German-speaking Jewish background. And they should have more in common, while I find it much more difficult to do what you did with so little in common. But isn't it also a question of what you said, the locality, that the more local poem is, the harder it is to translate. And this is because of the lacking referent. When you read something very local, you cannot follow the deixis if you're outside. It's the lack of referent. And that makes me so afraid for general culture. This makes me afraid about globalization, because we do not share the same reference of the books you just mentioned of a general Western culture. Everybody has another culture, and they can be very educated afterwards. So it's my question of the receptivity of a language and of the local referent. Thank you.
No, I agree with your remarks, and it's I think it's hard to when you translate poetry to replicate very local context for someone else who is not from this country, not from this language. And as an advisor, you must find perhaps just some as a translator some devices which could rendered in a different way. But it's a pity that I don't have now, we should withdraw into a little workshop and with a translation of Mandelstam and then by Paul Celan, and then I can show you how much he changed. Mm. Also, they are from the same background, but I think Mandelstam spoke no German.
But there are many different kinds of legitimate translation, isn't there? I mean, a poet's for instance, you were talking about Ingeborg Bachmann's translations of Montale. How do they compare with Anno Elbling's translations? Which are more literal? Which are more scholarly? Which are more poetic? Which take more liberties? Can you?
Ingeborg Bachmann takes much more liberties. I think Anno Elbling is very scholarly, very much, very too faithful.
Yes. Uh-huh. So that's a big. I think that's a big pitfall in translation is to be flat-footedly literally faithful. That, of course, that's the famous debate between Edmund Wilson and Nabokov about Pushkin. Mm. And Nabokov's idea of a translation of Pushkin was a trot, basically, an annotated trot, and that's not what we're talking about here, I think.
No. I see two hands there. You, sir, and then Mr. Viscusi.
I'm Ben Taylor, and I read in Iris Origo's biography of Leopardi that he was not allowed to leave the house unaccompanied, even at the age of, was it 21, 22? I wonder if you could say something, Jonathan, about the, what that pressure cooker was in Recanati.
It wasn't Recanati, it was Casa Leopardi, I think.
Well, signora.
I think his family was very reactionary. His mother was very deeply religious and life-hating, I think is the word that you would say. And he wrote a famous description of her about how when her children died, she was happy for them that they could be received into heaven right away. And she joy in life was not her strong suit. And I think Leopardi actually only in his very last years when he lived in Naples with Antonio Ranieri, that was the only time that he was really free of his parents. They kept him on a very short economic leash. He would go to Bologna or Milan or Rome and try to find work. And Florence, he always had to go back to Recanati because he didn't have any visible means of support. So I think that his personal unhappiness, which was partly psychological because of this family situation, and also he had physical deformities. He was a very lonely, unloved man. I've forgotten how I started my sentence, but in any case, the pressure cooker was generated from this family situation and his own personal maladies and misfortunes.
Yeah, Mr. Viscusi.
My name is Anthony Viscusi. I have always been concerned with this question of receptivity of certain languages for translations. And growing up, one feels obliged, if not forced, to read Goethe because he's supposed to be one of the greatest poets of all time. And I could never convince myself, not knowing German, that he was a great poet, and all of the translations that I came upon seemed to indicate that he was just an ordinary one.
Are you speaking about Italian translations?
Oh, English.
Oh, English,
English. Until a couple of decades ago, maybe just one decade ago, I came upon translations into Italian, and how great! And when nobody's home, I read them to myself aloud because they are really so beautiful.
Who is the translator?
I don't know. I don't remember.
The poor translator.
And then I found the explanation, and I read somewhere that Leopardi had stated that the two languages that are most receptive to translations are German and Italian. And I've read Shakespeare in French, and in Italian is great. In French, not so great. I mean, the language crumbles under the weight of Shakespeare. But then there is also the question of Dante. I've read dozens of translations into English, and most of them horrible, but still, he's a great, great poet. The poetry comes through no matter what the language of the translator is. So I would like you to comment on this question of receptivity. By the way, I could never find the passage in Leopardi where he states that French and that German and Italian are the two best languages into which to translate.
Thank you.
Well, I'd like to hear what Joachim thinks about this, but I'll just say that I think that there are not all languages receive all literatures well, and I do think that there are. Was it Leone Traverso? Was he the translator of? He's a wonderful translator mm-hmm. of German into yes. Italian, and I sometimes read other poets in Italian translations because I think that they're better served than in English sometimes. But
why?
Well, because. Well, Rosanna probably has some ideas about this, but there's a certain regularity to the, a certain concision to the way things are structured, that maybe there's some affinities between, it's funny because English and German ought to be, have affinities, that they have some affinities,
they
don't
times.
Have others. Yeah.
My German friends tell me that Shakespeare in German is a great monument in German.
It is. It's great.
Yeah.
In Schiller's translation, or is it? Or
I was never interested in Schiller. No, but I like to hear that Italian and German are the languages with the greatest receptivity. But I heard it for the first time, and I think that the German language is at the same time grammatically rather clearly structured. But at the same time, there's a great flexibility because we can separate words or put three nouns together and create a kind of a special rhythm or a pattern of music corresponding to the original. But what is interesting, it just came to my mind, there was a, since you mentioned Goethe, I think his one of his last books, the West Eastern Divan, is really mm-hmm. among the greatest German poems ever written. Now, what is interesting, it all goes back to Hafiz,
yes.
and there was an Austrian guy, Hammer Burgstall, who translated Hafiz for the first time into German. And the translations were absolutely horrible. Mm. Not correct, very bad German, nothing. But somehow, the content... Also, the translation was so bad, spilled over, and it created in the whole of Germany a fashion, you know, to write such poems. And wherever you look around, August von Platen, Friedrich Rückert, who then translated himself again, Hafiz, or Goethe, it's absolutely amazing how much also a bad translation can really create a whole stream of very important literature.
Yes.
Faust, the first part, it was translated by Nerval, very elegant, very French, very charming. But to me, as a German, it's not Faust. And but Pasternak's translation in Russian, this renders a whole German medieval darkness. Pasternak, so Russian, obviously, was more receptive, or is, I mean, Nerval, you cannot say this is a bad poet, so a poet by a poet, but it's Nerval, it's more than 50% Nerval. And whereas Pasternak's translation is really, you feel Faust. That's what I want.
Thank you.
Goethe.
Yes, thank you. I saw another hand right behind you. Yes.
Hi, my name's Lauren Neef. I just first wanted to say, I feel like you've quoted Frost. But it can't really go I don't want to let it go unanswered by Benjamin's famous introduction to his translation of Baudelaire, right? The task of the translator, which is and his response would be that poetry is the only thing that gets translated when you're translating, right? Poetry is not what's lost in translation, but it is the only thing that can get translated. So you must be familiar with the essay, so... I would love to hear a little bit more of your response to that. And then a second short question is just since Leopardi is sort of the Romantic period, and we've talked about Goethe and some of the other Romantic poets, you're talking about the vernacular and the plainness of his speech and his anecdotes of the town just sounds like Wordsworth to me. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about his relationship to Wordsworth, if there is one. What was he reading a translation? Was he reading him at all? Did Wordsworth know Leopardi, et cetera?
I don't know of any evidence that they knew each other's work, but Leopardi did know English, and he was interested in late 18th century poetry that he'd read on Nazca. But I think the comparison with Wordsworth is very apt and relevant, and many people have made it. But as far as what is translated, I can't remember what Benjamin says, but I think it has to do with that some essence of the
sheer language.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I think my comment on that would be that what brings you to the sheer language is multiple translations. You know, I was reading. I remember we commissioned Richard Howard to translate Proust at one point. He never did it, but he was superstitious about it about doing it. But I remember saying at the time, it's going to make Proust more interesting in English, if you can compare Scott Moncrief and Howard, and I think multiple translations of a poem, it's a way of centering in on something ineffable,
yes,
in the other language. By exclusion, you're excluding this, you're excluding that,
yes,
you're excluding this. So what's left? And that's. Yes.
Do you want to address the Walter Benjamin question briefly, or no? Okay.
This,
another hand?
This person has been asking,
yes,
a lot.
Please. Thank you for that, and I want to thank you for this wonderful panel. I've enjoyed it so much. I'm Susan Bernofsky, and thank you so much for plugging my 3 o'clock panel, which I'm about to go prep my panelists for at Cooper Union. But I want to bring hope to those who are unable to read Goethe in Italian, and to tell you, Jonathan, that Joel Agee is flirting with the idea of translating Faust, and shouldn't you call him and make him agree to do it right away? Because it'll be splendid. But I actually have a question. I'm really interested in the interaction between the kind of writing that writers do when they write and the kind of writing that translators do when they translate, and both of you, in fact, all three of you, are poets as well as translators, and I'd be really interested in what you could tell us about the interaction between writing and translation in your writing and translating lives.
Great question. Well, how about you?
Well, I think translating poems is also writing poems, but in a very defined framework, with perhaps less freedom, less liberty. On the other hand, I think that looking back, I think that John Ashbery, for example, has influenced me in my own writing with his kind of parlando and being rather relaxed. So perhaps I started more like a rather abstract formalist, if I may say so. And he taught me, which is true for a lot of American poetry, to be more narrative, to be more easygoing, and so on. So I think it's unavoidable that there are some influences, but I think not very big ones. I think the main thing is that translation is also an incredible exercise with your own language. You know, and you explore so many possibilities, so many. You have to make decisions all the time, and I think it's the best training for your own writing.
Wonderful.
I would agree wholeheartedly. I always did translation as a way of doing poetry, and I think that I try to do translations that are accurate, first of all, but that are also objects in my own language that have in some sort of integrity that aren't just too faithful, as you said about faithful but not too faithful. Let's put it that way. And I think that it certainly has informed my own writing. I'm publishing another book next year, and I know that the work that I was doing on Leopardi seeped into my own writing in ways that I'm not conscious of. I wasn't consciously imitating, but if you spend 10 years on something, it somehow gets into your pores somehow.
Yes. We have 1 minute, so we'll give you the last question.
My name is Janne Zeller. I'm a Danish novelist, but very culturally mixed. And my question is about the thing of the link between culture and language, because you know language is evidently a reflection of culture, and for culturally mixed people, that's a very a straitjacket in a way that you can only overcome by twisting and inventing language so it reflects what goes on in the head. But how do you deal with that when you translate multicultural poets? Because you don't go from one cultural setting to another. You go from an invented setting, in a sense, to something you must also invent. Or which kind of liberties do you take yourself then?
Well, I think that's a topic for another discussion of 2 hours.
Yes. It's multiplying the variables enormously. I think it's all a tremendous experiment in recombinant DNA, and that we're changing every minute and being changed every minute by the language that comes into us and that we emit. I thank you all for coming, and I hope you go running out and have a lot of fun in other sessions of this festival. Bye-bye.